"There again," said I, stopping before Herbert with my open hands held out as if they contained the desperation of the case. "I know nothing of his life. It has almost made me mad to sit here of a night and see him before me so bound up with my fortunes and misfortunes, and yet so unknown to me, except as the miserable wretch who terrified me 2 days in my childhood." Herbert got up and linked his arm in mine, and we slowly walked to and fro together, studying the carpet. "Handel," said Herbert, stopping, "you feel convinced that you can take no further benefits from him, do you?"
"Fully. Surely you would, too, if you were in my place."
"And you feel convinced that you must break with him?"
"Herbert, how can you ask me?"
"And you have, and are bound to have, that tenderness for the life he has risked on your account, that you must save him, if possible, from throwing it away. Then you must get him out of England before you stir a finger to extricate yourself. That done, extricate yourself, in heaven's name, and we'll see it out together, dear old boy."
It was a comfort to shake hands upon it, and walk up and down again with only that done.
"Now, Herbert," said I, "with reference to gaining some knowledge of his history, there is but one way that I know of. I must ask him point blank."
"Yes, ask him," said Herbert,
"when we sit at breakfast in the morning."
For he had said, on taking leave of Herbert, that he would come to breakfast with us. With this project formed, we went to bed. I had the wildest dreams concerning him, and woke unrefreshed. I woke, too, to recover the fear which I had lost in the night of his being found out as a return transport. Waking, I never lost that fear. He came round at the appointed time, took out his jackknife, and sat down to his meal. He was full of plans,
"for his gentleman's coming out strong and like a gentleman,"
and urged me to begin speedily upon the pocket-book which he had left in my possession. He considered the chambers and his own lodging as temporary residences, and advised me to look out at once
for a fashionable crib
near Hyde Park, in which he could have
a shakedown.
When he had made an end of his breakfast, and was wiping his knife on his leg, I said to him, without a word of preface, "After you were gone last night, I told my friend of the struggle that the soldiers found you engaged in on the marshes when we came up. You remember?"
"Remember," said he. "I think so."
"We want to know something about that man, and about you. It's strange to know no more about either, and particularly you, than I was able to tell last night. Is not this a good time as another for our knowing more?"
"Well," he said, after consideration, "you're on your oath, you know, Pip's comrade."
"Assuredly," replied Herbert.
"As to anything I say, you know," he insisted, "the oath applies to all."
"I understand it to do so."
"Now look here. Whatever I done is worked out and paid for," he insisted again.
"So be it." He took out his black pipe and was going to fill it with negro head when, looking at the tangle of tobacco in his hand, he seemed to think it might perplex the thread of his narrative. He put it back again, stuck his pipe in a buttonhole of his coat, spread a hand on each knee, and after turning an angry eye on the fire for a few silent moments, looked around at us and said what follows.
Chapter 42.
"Dear boy and Pip's comrade, I'm not a-going to foretell you my life like a song or a storybook, but to give it you short and handy, I'll put it at once into a mouthful of English. In jail and out of jail, in jail and out of jail, in jail and out of jail. There, you've got it. That's my life pretty much down to such times as I got shipped off. Arthur Pip stood my friend. I've been done everything to pretty well, except hanged. I've been locked up as much as a silver tea kettle. I've been carted here and carted there, and put out of this town and put out of that town, and stuck in the stocks and whipped and worried and drove. I've no more notion where I was born than you have, if so much. I first became aware of myself down in Essex, a-thieving turnips for my living. Someone had run away from me, a man, a tinker, and he took the fire with him and left me wery cold. I know my name to be Magwitch, christened Abel. How did I know? Much as I know the birds' names in the hedges to be chaffinch, sparrow, thrush. I might have thought it was all lies together, only as the birds' names come out true, I suppose mine did. So far as I could find, there weren't a soul that see young Abel Magwitch with as little on him as in him, but what caught fright at him, and either drove him off or took him up. I was took up, took up, took up, to the extent that I regularly growed up, took up. This is the way it was, and when I was a ragged little creature, as much as to be pitted as ever I see, not that I looked in the glass, for there weren't many insides of furnished houses known to me. I got the name of being hardened. This is a terrible hardened one, they says to prison wizarders picking out me. May be said to live in jails, this boy. Then they looked at me, and I looked at them, and they measured my head, some on. They'd better measured my stomach. And others on give me tracts, what I couldn't read, and made me speeches, what I couldn't understand. They always went on again me about the devil. But what the devil was I to do? I must put something into my stomach, mustn't I? Howsomever, I'm a-getting low, and I know what's due. Here, boy, and Pip's comrade, don't you be afeard of me being low. Tramping, begging, thieving, working sometimes when I could, though that warn't as often as you may think, till you put the question whether you would have been over-ready to give me work yourselves. A bit of a poacher, a bit of a labourer, a bit of a wagoner, a bit of a haymaker, a bit of a hawker, a bit of most things that don't pay and lead to trouble. I got to be a man. A deserting soldier in a traveller's rest, what lay it up to the chin under a lot of taters, learnt me to read, and a travelling giant, what signed his name at a penny a time, learnt me to write. I weren't locked up as often now as formerly, but I wore out my good share of key metal still. At Epsom Races, a matter of over 20 years ago, I got acquainted with a man whose skull I'd crack with this poker, like the claw of a lobster if I got it on this hob. His right name was Compeyson, and that's the man, dear boy, what you see me a-pounding in the ditch, according to what you truly told your comrade arter I was gone last night. He set up for a gentleman, this Compeyson, and he'd been to a public boarding school and had learning. He was a smooth one to talk, and was a dab at the ways of gentlefolks. He was good-looking, too. It was the night afore the great race, when I found him on the heath, in a booth that I'd known on. Him and some more was a-sitting among the tables when I went in, and the landlord, which had a knowledge of me, and was a sporting one, called him out and said, "I think this is a man that might suit you," meaning I was. Compeyson, he looks at me very noticing, and I look at him. He has a watch and a chain and a ring and a breastpin and a handsome suit of clothes. "To judge from appearances, you're out of luck," says Compeyson to me. "Yes, master, and I've never been in it much. I had come out of Kingston jail last on a vagrancy committal. None but what it might have been for something else, but it warn't." "Luck changes," says Compeyson. "Perhaps yours is going to change." I says, "I hope it may be so. There's room." "What can you do?" says Compeyson. "Eat and drink," I says, "if you'll find the materials." Compeyson laughed, looked at me again, very noticing, gave me 5 shilling, and appointed me for next night, same place. I went to Compeyson next night, same place, and Compeyson took me on to be his man and partner. And what was Compeyson's business in which we was to go partners? Compeyson's business was the swindling, handwriting, forging, stolen banknote passing and such like. All sorts of traps, as Compeyson could set with his head, and keep his own legs out of, and get the profits from, and let another man in for, was Compeyson's business. He'd no more heart than an iron file. He was as cold as death, and he had the head of the devil aforementioned. There was another in with Compeyson, as was called Arthur, not as being so christened, but as a surname. He was in a decline, and was a shadow to look at. Him and Compeyson had been in a bad thing with a rich lady some years afore, and they'd made a pot of money by it. But Compeyson betted and gamed, and he'd have run through the king's taxes. So Arthur was a-dying, and a-dying poor and with the horrors on him, and Compeyson's wife, which Compeyson kicked mostly, was a-having pity on him when she could, and Compeyson was having pity on nothing and nobody. I might have took a warning by Arthur, but I didn't. and I won't pretend I was particular, for where had been the good on it, dear boy and comrade? So I began with Compeyson, and a poor tool I was in his hands. Arthur lived at the top of Compeyson's house, over nigh Brentford it was, and Compeyson kept a careful account again him for board and lodging, in case he should ever get better to work it out. But Arthur soon settled the account. The second or third time as ever I see him, he come a-tearing down into Compeyson's parlour late at night, in only a flannel gown, with his hair all in a sweat, and he says to Compeyson's wife, "Sally, she really is upstairs along o' me now, and I can't get rid of her. She's all in white," he says, "with white flowers in her hair, and she's awful mad, and she's got a shroud hanging over her arm, and she says she'll put it on me at 5 in the morning. Says Compeyson, "Why, you fool, don't you know she's got a living body? And how should she be up there without coming through the door or in the window and up the stairs?" "I don't know how she's standing there," says Arthur, shivering dreadful with the horrors, "but she's standing in the corner at the foot of the bed, awful mad, and over where her heart's broke. You broke it. There's drops of blood." Compeyson spoke hardly, but he was always a coward. "Go up along o' this drivelling sick man," he says to his wife, "and Magwitch, lend her a hand, will you?" And he never come nigh himself. Compeyson's wife and me took him up to the bed again, and he raved most dreadful. "Why, look at her," he cries out. "She's a-shaking the shroud at me. Don't you see her? Look at her eyes. Ain't it awful to see her so mad?" "Next," he cries, "she'll put it on me, and then I'm done for. Take it away from her. Take it away." And then he catched hold of us, and kept on a-talking to her and answering of her, till I half believed I see her myself. Compeyson's wife, being used to him, give him some liquor to get the horrors off, and by he quieted. "Ah, oh, she's gone. Has her keeper been for her?" he says. "Yes," says Compeyson's wife. "Did you tell him to lock and bar her in?" "Yes." "And to take that ugly thing away from her?" "Yes, yes, all right." "You're a good creature," he says. "Don't leave me, whatever you do, and thank you." He rested pretty quiet till it might want a few minutes of 5, and then he starts up with a scream, and screams out, "Here she is! She's got the shroud again! She's unfolding it! She's coming out of the corner! She's coming to the bed! Hold me, both of you, one on each side! Don't let her touch me with it! She missed me that time! Don't let her throw it over my shoulders! Don't let her lift me up to get it round me! She's lifting me up! Keep me down!" Then he lifted himself up hard, and was dead. Compeyson took it easy as a good riddance for both sides. Him and me was soon busy, and first he swore me, being ever artful, on my own book, this here little black book, dear boy, what I swore your comrade on. Not to go into things that Compeyson planned and I done, which would take a week, I'll simply say to you, dear boy, and Pip's comrade, that man got me into such nets as made me his black slave. I was always in debt to him, always under his thumb, always a-working, always a-getting into danger. He was younger than me, but he'd got craft, and he'd got learning, and he overmatched me 500 times and told no mercy. My missus, as I had the hard times with, stop, though, I ain't brought her in.
He looked about him in a confused way, as if he'd lost his place in the book of his remembrance, and he turned his face to the fire, and spread his hands broader on his knees, and lifted them off and put them on again.
"There ain't no need to go into it," he said, looking round once more. "The time with Compeyson was a'most as hard a time as ever I had. That said, all said. Did I tell you as I was tried alone for misdemeanour while with Compeyson?"
I answered no.
"Well," he said, "I was, and got convicted. As to took up on suspicion, there was 2 or 3 times in the 4 or 5 years that it lasted, but evidence was wanting. At last, me and Compeyson was both committed for felony, on charge of putting stolen notes in circulation, and there was other charges behind. Compeyson says to me, 'Separate defences, no communication,' and that was all, and I was so miserably poor that I sold all the clothes I had, except what hung on my back, afore I could get jaggers. When we were put into the dock, I noticed first of all what a gentleman Compeyson looked, with his curly hair and his black clothes and his white pocket handkerchief, and what a common sort of a wretch I looked. When the prosecution opened and the evidence was put short aforehand, I noticed how heavy it all bore on me and how light on him. When the evidence were given the box, I noticed how it was always me that had come forward and could be swore to, how it was always me that the money had been paid to, how it was always me that had seemed to work the thing and get the profit. But when the defence came on, then I see the plan plainer. For, says the counsellor for Compeyson, "My lord and gentlemen, here you has afore you, side by side, two persons as your eyes can separate wide. One the younger, well brought up, who will be spoke to as such. One the elder, ill brought up, who will be spoke to as such. One the younger, seldom if ever seen in these here transactions, and only suspected. T'other, the elder, always seen in them, and always with his guilt brought home. Can you doubt if there is but one in it, which is the one, and if there is two in it, which is much the worst one? And such like. And when it come to character, what did Compeyson as had been to school, and what did his schoolfellows as was in this position and in that, and what did him as had been knowed by witnesses in such clubs and societies, and nowt to his disadvantage? And weren't it me as had been tried afore, and as had been knowed up hill and down dale in bridewells and lock-ups? And when it comes to speech-making, weren't it Compeyson as could speak to him with his face dropping every now and then into his white pocket handkerchief? And with worses in his speech, too. And weren't it me as could only say, 'Gentlemen, this man at my side is a most precious rascal.' And when the verdict come, weren't it Compeyson as was recommended to mercy on account of good character and bad company, and given up all the information he could again me? And weren't it me as got never a word but guilty? And when I says to Compeyson, 'Once out of this court, I'll smash that face of yourn,' ain't it Compeyson as prays the judge to be protected, and gets two turnkeys stood betwixt us? And when we're sentenced, ain't it him as gets 7 year, and me 14? And ain't it him as the judge is sorry for, because he might have done so well? And ain't it me the judge perceives to be an old offender of violent passion, likely to come to worse?"
He had worked himself into a state of great excitement, but he checked it, took two or three short breaths, swallowed as often, and stretching out his hands towards me, said in a reassuring manner,
"I ain't a-going to be low, dear boy."
He had so heated himself that he took out his handkerchief and wiped his face and head and neck and hands before he could go on.
"I said to Compeyson that I'd smash that face of his, and I swore Lord smash mine to do it. We was in the same prison ship, but I couldn't get at him for long, though I tried. At last I come behind him, and I hit him on the cheek to turn him round, and got a smashing one at him, when I was seen and seized. The black hole of that ship warn't a strong one to a judge of black holes that could swim and dive. I escaped to the shore, and I was hiding among the graves there, envying them as was in them and all over, when I first see my boy."
He regarded me with a look of affection that made him almost abhorrent to me again, though I had felt great pity for him.
"But my boy, I was to give to understand as Compeyson was out on them marshes too. On my soul, I half believed he escaped in his terror to get quit of me, not knowing it was me as had got ashore. I hunted him down. I smashed his face. And now, says I, as the worst thing I can do, caring nothing for myself, I'll drag you back. And I'd have swum off, towing him by his hair, if it had come to that, and I'd got him aboard without the soldiers. Of course, he'd much the best of it to the last. His character was so good. He had escaped when he was made half wild by me and my murderous intentions, and his punishment was light. I was put in irons, brought to trial again, and sent for life. I didn't stop for life, dear boy and Pip's comrade, being here."
He wiped himself again, as he had done before, and then slowly took his tangle of tobacco from his pocket, and plucked his pipe from his buttonhole, and slowly filled it and began to smoke.
"Is he dead?" I asked after a silence.
"Is who dead, dear boy?"
"Compeyson."
"He hopes I am. If he's alive, you may be sure."
With a fierce look.
"I never heard no more of him."
Herbert had been writing with his pencil in the cover of a book. He softly pushed the book over to me, as Provis stood smoking with his eyes on the fire. And I read in it, "Young Havisham's name was Arthur. Compeyson is the man who professed to be Miss Havisham's lover." I shut the book, and nodded slightly to Herbert, and put the book by. But we neither of us said anything, and both looked at Provis as he stood smoking by the fire. Chapter 43. Why should I pause to ask how much of my shrinking from Provis might be traced to Estella? Why should I loiter on my road to compare the state of mind in which I had tried to rid myself of the stain of the prison before meeting her at the coach office, with the state of mind in which I now reflected on the abyss between Estella in her pride and beauty, and the returned transport whom I harboured? The road would be none the smoother for it. The end would be none the better for it. He would not be helped, nor I extenuated. A new fear had been engendered in my mind by his narrative, or rather, his narrative had given form and purpose to the fear that was already there. If Compeyson were alive, and should discover his return, I could hardly doubt the consequence. That Compeyson stood in mortal fear of him, neither of the two could know much better than I, and that any such man as that man had been described to me would hesitate to release himself for good from a dreaded enemy by the safe means of becoming an informer was scarcely to be imagined. Never had I breathed, and never would I breathe, or so I resolved, a word of Estella to Provis. But I said to Herbert that before I could go abroad, I must see both Estella and Miss Havisham. This was when we were left alone on the night of the day when Provis told us his story. I resolved to go out to Richmond next day, and I went. On my presenting myself at Mrs. Brandley's, Estella's maid was called to tell me that Estella had gone into the country. Where? To Satty's house, as usual. Not as usual, I said, for she had never yet gone there without me. When was she coming back? There was an air of reservation in the answer which increased my perplexity, and the answer was that her maid believed she was only coming back at all for a little while. I could make nothing of this, except that it was meant that I should make nothing of it, and went home again in complete discomfiture. Another night consultation with Herbert, after Provis was gone home, I always took him home and always looked well about me, led us to the conclusion that nothing should be said about going abroad until I came back from Miss Havisham's. In the meantime, Herbert and I were to consider separately what it would be best to say, whether we should devise any pretense of being afraid that he was under suspicious observation, or whether I, who had never yet been abroad, should propose an expedition. We both knew that I had but to propose anything, and he would consent. We agreed that his remaining days in his present hazard was not to be thought of. Next day, I had the meanness to feign that I was under a blinding promise to go down to Joe, but I was capable of almost any meanness towards Joe or his name. Provis was to be strictly careful while I was gone, and Herbert was to take the charge of him that I had taken. I was to be absent only one night, and on my return, the gratification of his impatience for my starting as a gentleman on a greater scale was to be begun. It occurred to me then, and as I afterwards found to Herbert also, that he might be best got across the water on that pretense, as to make purchases or the like. Having thus cleared the way for my expedition to Miss Havisham's, I set off by the early morning coach before it was yet light, and was out in the open country road when the day came creeping on, halting and whimpering and shivering, and wrapped in patches of cloud and rags of mist like a beggar. When we drove up to the Blue Boar, after a drizzly ride, whom shall I see coming out under the gateway, toothpick in hand to look at the coach, but Bentley Drummle? As he pretended not to see me, I pretended not to see him. It was a very lame pretense on both sides, the lamer because we both went into the coffee-room where he had just finished his breakfast and where I had ordered mine. It was poisonous to me to see him in the town, for I very well knew why he had come there. pretending to read a smeary newspaper long out of date, which had nothing half so legible in its local news as the foreign matter of coffee, pickles, fish sauces, gravy, melted butter and wine, with which it was sprinkled all over, as if it had taken the measles in a highly irregular form, I sat at my table while he stood before the fire. By degrees it became an enormous injury to me that he stood before the fire, and I got up, determined to have my share of it. I had to put my hand behind his legs for the poker when I went up to the fireplace to stir the fire, but still pretended not to know him.
"Is this a cut?" said Mr. Drummle.
"Oh," said I, poker in hand, "it's you, is it? How do you do? I was wondering who it was who kept the fire off." With that I poked tremendously, and having done so, planted myself side by side with Mr. Drummle, my shoulders squared and my back to the fire.
"You have just come down?"
said Mr. Drummle, edging me a little away with his shoulder.
"Yes," said I, edging him a little away with my shoulder.
"Beastly place," said Drummle. "Your part of the country, I think."
"Yes," I assented. "I am told it's very like your Shropshire."
"Not in the least like it," said Drummle.
Here Mr. Drummle looked at his boots, and I looked at mine, and then Mr. Drummle looked at my boots, and I looked at his.
"Have you been here long?"
I asked, determined not to yield an inch of the fire.
"Long enough to be tired of it,"
returned Drummle, pretending to yawn, but equally determined.
"Do you stay here long?"
"Can't say,"
answered Mr. Drummle.
"Do you?"
"Can't say," said I.
I felt here, through a tingling in my blood, that if Mr. Drummle's shoulder had claimed another hair's breadth of room, I should have jerked him into the window. Equally, that if my shoulder had urged a similar claim, Mr. Drummle would have jerked me into the nearest box. He whistled a little. So did I.
"Large tract of marshes about here, I believe,"
said Drummle.
"Yes, what of that?" said I.
Mr. Drummle looked at me, and then at my boots, and then said,
"Ha-ha!"
and laughed. "Are you amused, Mr. Drummle?"
"No,"
said he.
"Not particularly. I'm going out for a ride in the saddle. I mean to explore those marshes for amusement. Out-of-the-way villages there, they tell me. Curious little public houses, and smithies, and that."
"Waiter!"
"Yes, sir."
"Is that horse of mine ready?"
"Brought round to the door, sir."
"I say, look here, you, sir. The lady won't ride today. The weather won't do."
"Very good, sir."
"And I don't dine, because I'm going to dine at the lady's."
"Very good, sir."
Then Drummle glanced at me with an insolent triumph on his great jowled face that cut me to the heart, dull as he was, and so exasperated me that I felt inclined to take him in my arms, as the robber in the storybook is said to have taken the old lady, and seat him on the fire. One thing was manifest to both of us, and that was that until relief came, neither of us could relinquish the fire. There we stood, well squared up before it, shoulder to shoulder and foot to foot, with our hands behind us, not budging an inch. The horse was visible outside in the drizzle at the door. My breakfast was put on table. Drummle's was cleared away. The waiter invited me to begin. I nodded. We both stood our ground.
"Have you been to the Grove since?"
said Drummle.
"No," said I. "I had quite enough of the Finches the last time I was there."
"Was that when we had a difference of opinion?"
"Yes,"
I replied, very shortly.
"Come, come, they let you off easily enough," sneered Drummle. "You shouldn't have lost your temper."
"Mr. Drummle," said I, "you are not competent to give advice on that subject. When I lose my temper, not that I admit having done so on that occasion, I don't throw glasses."
"I do," said Drummle.
After glancing at him once or twice in an increased state of smouldering ferocity, I said, "Mr. Drummle, I did not seek this conversation, and I don't think it's an agreeable one."
"I'm sure it's not,"
said he, superciliously over his shoulder.
"I don't think anything about it."
"And therefore," I went on, "with your leave, I will suggest that we hold no kind of communication in future."
"Quite my opinion," said Drummle. "And what I should have suggested myself, or done, more likely, without suggesting. But don't lose your temper. Haven't you lust enough without that?"
"What do you mean, sir?"
"Waiter,"
said Drummle, by way of answering me. The waiter reappeared.
Look here, you, sir. You quite understand that the young lady don't ride today, and that I dine at the young lady's?
Quite so, sir.
When the waiter had felt my fast-cooling teapot with the palm of his hand, and had looked imploringly at me, and had gone out, Drummle, careful not to move the shoulder next to me, took a cigar from his pocket and bit the end off, but showed no sign of stirring. Choking and boiling as I was, I felt that we could not go a word further without introducing Estella's name, which I could not endure to hear him utter, and therefore I looked stonily at the opposite wall, as if there were no one present, and forced myself to silence. How long we might have remained in this ridiculous position, it is impossible to say, but for the incursion of three thriving farmers, laid on by the waiter, I think, who came into the coffee-room unbuttoning their greatcoats and rubbing their hands, and before whom, as they charged at the fire, we were obliged to give way. I saw him through the window seizing his horse's mane and mounting in his blundering, brutal manner, and sidling and backing away. I thought he was gone, when he came back, calling for a light for the cigar in his mouth, which he had forgotten. A man in a dust-coloured dress appeared with what was wanted, I could not have said from where, whether from the inn-yard or the street or where not, and as Drummle leaned down from the saddle and lighted his cigar and laughed, with a jerk of his head toward the coffee-room windows, the slouching shoulders and ragged hair of this man whose back was towards me, reminded me of Orlick. Too heavily out of sorts to care much at the time whether it were he or no, or, after all, to touch the breakfast, I washed the weather and the journey from my face and hands, and went out to the memorable old house that it would have been so much the better for me never to have entered, never to have seen.
Chapter 44. In the room where the dressing-table stood, and where the wax candles burnt on the wall, I found Miss Havisham and Estella. Miss Havisham seated on a settee near the fire, and Estella on a cushion at her feet. Estella was knitting, and Miss Havisham was looking on. They both raised their eyes as I went in, and both saw an alteration in me. I derived that from the look they interchanged.
"And what wind," said Miss Havisham, "blows you here, Pip?"
Though she looked steadily at me, I saw that she was rather confused. Estella, pausing for a moment in her knitting with her eyes upon me, and then going on, I fancied that I read in the action of her fingers, as plainly as if she had told me in the dumb alphabet, that she perceived I had discovered my real benefactor. "Miss Havisham," said I went to Richmond yesterday to speak to Estella, and finding that some wind had blown her here, I followed. Miss Havisham motioning to me for the third or fourth time to sit down, I took the chair by the dressing-table, which I had often seen her occupy. With all that ruin at my feet and about me, it seemed a natural place for me that day. "What I had to say to Estella, Miss Havisham, I will say before you, presently, in a few moments. It will not surprise you. It will not displease you. I am as unhappy as you can ever have meant me to be." Miss Havisham continued to look steadily at me. I could see in the action of Estella's fingers as they worked that she attended to what I said, but she did not look up. "I have found out who my patron is. It is not a fortunate discovery, and is not likely ever to enrich me in reputation, station, fortune, anything. There are reasons why I must say no more of that. It is not my secret, but another's." As I was silent for a while, looking at Estella and considering how to go on, Miss Havisham repeated, "It is not your secret, but another's." "Well?" "When you first caused me to be brought here, Miss Havisham, when I belonged to the village over yonder that I wish I had never left, I suppose I did really come here as any other chance boy might have come, as a kind of servant, to gratify a want or a whim, and to be paid for it."
"Aye, Pip," replied Miss Havisham, steadily nodding her head. "You did."
"And that Mr. Jaggers—"
"Mr. Jaggers," said Miss Havisham, taking me up in a firm tone, "had nothing to do with it, and knew nothing of it. His being my lawyer, and his being the lawyer of your patron, is a coincidence. He holds the same relation towards numbers of people, and it might easily arise. Be that as it may, it did arise,
and was not brought about by anyone. Anyone might have seen in her haggard face that there was no suppression or evasion so far. "But when I fell into the mistake I have so long remained in, at least you led me on," said I.
"Yes," she returned, again nodding steadily. "I let you go on."
"Was that kind?"
"Who am I?"
cried Miss Havisham, striking her stick upon the floor and flashing into wrath so suddenly that Estella glanced up at her in surprise.
"Who am I, for God's sake, that I should be kind?"
It was a weak complaint to have made, and I had not meant to make it. I told her so as she sat brooding after this outburst.
"Well, well, well," she said. "What else?"
"I was liberally paid for my old attendance here," I said to soothe her, "in being apprenticed, and I have asked these questions only for my own information. What follows has another, and I hope more disinterested, purpose. In humouring my mistake, Miss Havisham, you punished, practised on, perhaps you will supply whatever term expresses your intention without offence, your self-seeking relations."
"I did. Why, they would have it so. So would you. What has been my history, that I should be at the pains of entreating either them or you not to have it so? You made your own snares. I never made them."
Waiting until she was quiet again, for this too flashed out of her in a wild and sudden way, I went on. "I have been thrown among one family of your relations, Miss Havisham, and have been constantly among them since I went to London. I know them to have been as honestly under my delusion as myself, and I should be false and base if I did not tell you, whether it is acceptable to you or no, and whether you are inclined to give credence to it or no, that you deeply wrong both Mr. Matthew Pocket and his son Herbert, if you suppose them to be otherwise than generous, upright, open, and incapable of anything designing or mean."
"They are your friends," said Miss Havisham.
"They made themselves my friends," said I, "when they supposed me to have superseded them, and when Sarah Pocket, Miss Georgiana, and Mistress Camilla were not my friends, I think." This contrasting of them with the rest seemed, I was glad to see, to do them good with her. She looked at me keenly for a little while, and then said quietly,
"What do you want for them?"
"Only," said I, "that you would not confound them with the others. They may be of the same blood, but, believe me, they are not of the same nature." Still looking at me keenly, Miss Havisham repeated,
"What do you want for them?"
"I'm not so cunning, you see," I said in answer, conscious that I reddened a little, "as that I could hide from you, even if I desired, that I do want something. Miss Havisham, if you would spare the money to do my friend Herbert a lasting service in life, but which from the nature of the case must be done without his knowledge, I could show you how."
"Why must it be done without his knowledge?"
she asked, settling her hands upon her stick, that she might regard me the more attentively. "Because," said I began the service myself more than 2 years ago without his knowledge, and I don't want to be betrayed. Why I fail in my ability to finish it, I cannot explain. But it is a part of the secret which is another person's, and not mine." She gradually withdrew her eyes from me and turned them on the fire. After watching it for what appeared in the silence and by the light of the slowly wasting candles to be a long time, she was roused by the collapse of some of the red coals, and looked towards me again, at first vacantly, then with a gradually concentrating attention. All this time, Estella knitted on. When Miss Havisham had fixed her attention on me, she said, speaking as if there had been no lapse in our dialogue,
"What else?"
"Estella," said I, turning to her now and trying to command my trembling voice, "you know I love you. You know that I have loved you long and dearly." She raised her eyes to my face on being thus addressed, and her fingers plied their work, and she looked at me with an unmoved countenance. I saw that Miss Havisham glanced from me to her, and from her to me. I should have said this sooner, but for my long mistake. It induced me to hope that Miss Havisham meant us for one another. While I thought you could not help yourself, as it were, I refrained from saying it. But I must say it now. preserving her unmoved countenance, and with her fingers still going. Estella shook her head.
"I know," said I in answer to that action. "I know I have no hope that I shall ever call you mine, Estella. I am ignorant what may become of me very soon, how poor I may be, or where I may go. Still, I love you. I have loved you ever since I first saw you in this house."
Looking at me, perfectly unmoved, and with her fingers busy, she shook her head again. It would have been cruel in Miss Havisham, horribly cruel, to practice on the susceptibility of a poor boy, and to torture me through all these years with a vain hope and an idle pursuit, if she had reflected on the gravity of what she did. But I think she did not. I think that in the endurances of her own trial, she forgot mine, Estella. I saw Miss Havisham put her hand to her heart and hold it there, as she sat looking by turns at Estella and at me.
"It seems," said Estella very calmly, "that there are sentiments, fancies, I don't know how to call them, which I am not able to comprehend. When you say you love me, I know what you mean as a form of words, but nothing more. You address nothing in my breast. You touch nothing there. I don't care for what you say at all. I have tried to warn you of this. Now have I not?"
I said in a miserable manner, "Yes."
"Yes, but you would not be warned, for you thought I did not mean it. Now, did you not think so?"
"I thought and hoped you could not mean it. You, so young and untried and beautiful, Estella, surely it is not in nature."
"It is in my nature," she returned,
and then she added with a stress upon the words,
"It is in the nature formed within me. I make a great difference between you and all other people when I say so much. I can do no more."
"Is it not true," said I, "that Bentley Drummle is in town here, and pursuing you?"
"It is quite true,"
she replied, referring to him with the indifference of utter contempt. "That you encourage him and ride out with him, and that he dines with you this very day." She seemed a little surprised that I should know it, but again replied,
"Quite true."
"You cannot love him, Estella." Her fingers stopped for the first time, as she retorted rather angrily,
"What have I told you? Do you still think, in spite of it, that I do not mean what I say?
You would never marry him, Estella." She looked towards Miss Havisham, and considered for a moment with her work in her hands. Then she said,
"Why not tell you the truth? I am going to be married to him."
I dropped my face into my hands, but was able to control myself better than I could have expected, considering what agony it gave me to hear her say those words. When I raised my face again, there was such a ghastly look upon Miss Havisham's that it impressed me, even in my passionate hurry and grief.
"Estella, dearest, dearest Estella, do not let Miss Havisham lead you into this fatal step. Put me aside for ever. You have done so, I well know. But bestow yourself on some worthier person than Drummle. Miss Havisham gives you to him at the greatest slight and injury that could be done to the many far better men who admire you, and to the few who truly love you. Among those few, there may be one who loves you even as dearly, though he has not loved you as long as I. Take him, and I can bear it better for your sake."
My earnestness awoke a wonder in her that seemed as if it would have been touched with compassion if she could have rendered me at all intelligible to her own mind.
"I am going," she said again, in a gentler voice, "to be married to him. The preparations for my marriage are making, and I shall be married soon."
"Why do you injuriously introduce the name of my mother by adoption?"
"It is my own act."
"Your own act, Estella? To fling yourself away upon a brute?"
"On whom should I fling myself away?"
she retorted with a smile. "Should I fling myself away upon the man who would the soonest feel, if people do feel such things, that I took nothing to him? There, it is done. I shall do well enough, and so will my husband. As to leading me into what you call this fatal step, Miss Havisham would have had me wait and not marry yet. But I am tired of the life I have led,
which has very few charms for me, and I am willing enough to change it. Say no more. We shall never understand each other.
Such a mean brute. Such a stupid brute, I urged in despair.
Don't be afraid of my being a blessing to him, said Estella. I shall not be that. Come, here is my hand. Do we part on this, you visionary boy or man?
Oh, Estella, I answered, as my bitter tears fell fast on her hand, do what I would to restrain them. Even if I remained in England and could hold my head up with the rest, how could I see you Drummle's wife?
Nonsense, she returned. Nonsense. This will pass in no time.
Never, Estella.
You will get me out of your thoughts in a week.
Out of my thoughts? You are part of my existence, part of myself. You have been in every line I have ever read since I first came here, the rough, common boy whose poor heart you wounded even then. You have been in every prospect I have ever seen since, on the river, on the sails of the ships, on the marshes, in the clouds, in the light, in the darkness, in the wind, in the woods, in the sea, in the streets. You have been the embodiment of every graceful fancy that my mind has ever become acquainted with. The stones of which the strongest London buildings are made are not more real or more impossible to be displaced by your hands than your presence and influence have been to me, there and everywhere, and will be. Estella, to the last hour of my life, you cannot choose but remain part of my character, part of the little good in me, part of the evil. But in this separation, I associate you only with the good. And I will faithfully hold you to that always, for you must have done me far more good than harm. Let me feel now what sharp distress I may. Oh, God bless you. God forgive you.
In what ecstasy of unhappiness I got these broken words out of myself, I don't know. The rhapsody welled up within me like blood from an inward wound and gushed out. I held her hands to my lips some lingering moments, and so I left her. But ever afterwards, I remembered, and soon afterwards with stronger reason, that while Estella looked at me merely with incredulous wonder, the spectral figure of Miss Havisham, her hands still covering her heart, seemed all resolved into a ghastly stare of pity and remorse.
All done, all gone. So much was done and gone, that when I went out at the gate, the light of day seemed of a darker colour than when I went in. For a while I hid myself among some lanes and bypaths, and then struck off to walk all the way to London. For I had by that time come to myself so far as to consider that I could not go back to the inn and see Drummle there, that I could not bear to sit upon the coach and be spoken to, that I could do nothing half so good for myself as tire myself out. It was past midnight when I crossed London Bridge, pursuing the narrow intricacies of the streets which at that time tended westward near the Middlesex shore of the river, my readiest access to the temple was close by the riverside through Whitefriars. I was not expected till tomorrow, but I had my keys, and if Herbert were gone to bed, could get to bed myself without disturbing him. As it seldom happened that I came in at that Whitefriars gate after the temple was closed, and as I was very muddy and weary, I did not take it ill that the night porter examined me with much attention as he held the gate a little way open for me to pass in. To help his memory, I mentioned my name.
I was not quite sure, sir, but I thought so. Here's a note, sir. The messenger that brought it said, would you be so good as to read it by my lantern?
Much surprised by the request, I took the note. It was directed to Philip Pip, Esquire, and on the top of the superscription were the words, "Please read this here." I opened it, the watchman holding up his light, and read inside, in Wemmick's writing, "Don't go home."
Chapter 45. Turning from the temple gate as soon as I had read the warning, I made the best of my way to Fleet Street, and there got a late hackney chariot and drove to the Hummums in Covent Garden. In those times, a bed was always to be got there at any hour of the night, and the chamberlain, letting me in at his ready wicket, lighted the candle next in order on his shelf, and showed me straight into the bedroom next in order to his list. It was a sort of vault on the ground floor at the back, with a despotic monster of a four-post bedstead in it, straddling over the whole place, putting one of his arbitrary legs into the fireplace and another into the doorway, and squeezing the wretched little washing-stand in quite a divinely righteous manner. As I had asked for a nightlight, the chamberlain had brought me in, before he left me, the good old constitutional rushlight of those virtuous days, an object like the ghost of a walking cane, which instantly broke its back if it were touched, which nothing could ever be lighted at, and which was placed in solitary confinement at the bottom of a high tin tower, perforated with round holes that made a staringly wide-awake pattern on the walls. When I had got into bed and lay there, footsore, weary, and wretched, I found that I could no more close my own eyes than I could close the eyes of this foolish Argus, and thus, in the gloom and death of the night, we stared at one another. What a doleful night! How anxious, how dismal, how long! There was an inhospitable smell in the room, of cold soot and hot dust, and as I looked up into the corners of the tester over my head, I thought what a number of blue-bottle flies from the butchers, and earwigs from the market, and grubs from the country, must be holding on up there, lying by for next summer. This led me to speculate whether any of them ever tumbled down, and then I fancied that I felt light falls on my face, a disagreeable turn of thought, suggesting other and more objectionable approaches up my back. When I had lain awake a little while, those extraordinary voices with which silence teems began to make themselves audible. The closet whispered, the fireplace sighed, the little washing-stand ticked, and one guitar string played occasionally in the chest of drawers. At about the same time, the eyes on the wall acquired a new expression, and in every one of those staring rounds, I saw written, "Don't go home." Whatever night fancies and night noises crowded on me, they never warded off this "don't go home." It plaited itself into whatever I thought of, as a bodily pain would have done. Not long before, I had read in the newspapers how a gentleman unknown had come to the Hummums in the night, and had gone to bed, and had destroyed himself, and had been found in the morning weltering in blood. It came into my head that he must have occupied this very vault of mine, and I got out of bed to assure myself that there were no red marks about. Then opened the door to look out into the passages, and cheer myself with the companionship of a distant light near which I knew the chamberlain to be dozing. But all this time, why I was not to go home, and what had happened at home, and when I should go home, and whether Provis was safe at home, were questions occupying my mind so busily that one might have supposed there could be no more room in it for any other theme. Even when I thought of Estella, and how we had parted that day for ever, and when I recalled all the circumstances of our parting, and all her looks and tones, and the action of her fingers while she knitted, even then I was pursuing here and there and everywhere the caution, "Don't go home." When at last I dozed in sheer exhaustion of mind and body, it became a vast shadowy verb which I had to conjugate, imperative mood, present tense. Do not thou go home, let him not go home, let us not go home, do not ye or you go home, let not them go home. Then potentially, I may not, and I cannot go home, and I might not, could not, would not, and should not go home, until I felt that I was going distracted, and rolled over on the pillow, and looked at the staring rounds upon the wall again. I had left directions that I was to be called at 7, for it was plain that I must see Wemmick before seeing anyone else, and equally plain that this was a case in which his Walworth sentiments only could be taken. It was a relief to get out of the room where the night had been so miserable, and I needed no second knocking at the door to startle me from my uneasy bed. The castle battlements rose upon my view at 8 o'clock. The little servant happening to be entering the fortress with 2 hot rolls, I passed through the postern and crossed the drawbridge in her company, and so came, without announcement, into the presence of Wemmick as he was making tea for himself and the aged. An open door afforded a perspective view of the aged in bed.
"Hello, Mr. Pip," said Wemmick. "You did come home, then?"
"Yes," I returned. "But I didn't go home."
"That's all right," said he, rubbing his hands. "I left a note for you at each of the temple gates on the chance. Which gate did you come to?"
I told him.
"I'll go round to the others in the course of the day and destroy the notes," said Wemmick. "It's a good rule never to leave documentary evidence if you can help it, because you don't know when it may be put in. I'm going to take a liberty with you. Would you mind toasting this sausage for the aged P?"
I said I should be delighted to do it.
"Then you can go about your work, Mary Ann," said Wemmick to the little servant, "which leaves us to ourselves, don't you see, Mr. Pip?" he added, winking, as she disappeared.
I thanked him for his friendship and caution, and our discourse proceeded in a low tone, while I toasted the aged sausage, and he buttered the crumb of the aged's roll.
"Now, Mr. Pip, you know," said Wemmick, "you and I understand one another. We are in our private and personal capacities, and we have been engaged in a confidential transaction before today. Official sentiments are one thing. We are extra-official."
I cordially assented. I was so very nervous that I had already lighted the aged sausage like a torch and been obliged to blow it out.
"I accidentally heard yesterday morning," said Wemmick, "being in a certain place where I once took you. Even between you and me, it's as well not to mention names when avoidable."
"Much better not," said I. "I understand you."
"I heard there by chance yesterday morning," said Wemmick, "that a certain person not altogether of uncolonial pursuits and not unpossessed of portable property, I don't know who it may really be, we won't name this person."
"Not necessary," said I,
"had made some little stir in a certain part of the world where a good many people go, not always in gratification of their own inclinations, and not quite irrespective of the government expense."
In watching his face, I made quite a firework of the aged sausage, and greatly discomposed both my own attention and Wemmick's, for which I apologized.
"By disappearing from such place, and being no more heard of thereabouts, from which," said Wemmick, "conjectures have been raised and theories formed. I also heard that you at your chambers in Garden Court Temple had been watched and might be watched again."
"By whom?" said I.
"I wouldn't go into that," said Wemmick evasively. "It might clash with official responsibilities. I heard it, as I have in my time heard other curious things in the same place. I don't tell it you on information received. I heard it."
He took the toasting fork and sausage from me as he spoke, and set forth the aged's breakfast neatly on a little tray. Previous to placing it before him, he went into the aged's room with a clean white cloth and tied the same under the old gentleman's chin and propped him up, and put his nightcap on one side and gave him quite a rakish air. Then he placed his breakfast before him with great care and said,
"All right, ain't you, aged P?"
To which the cheerful aged replied,
"All right, John, my boy, all right."
As there seemed to be a tacit understanding that the aged was not in a presentable state, and was therefore to be considered invisible, I made a pretense of being in complete ignorance of these proceedings. "This watching of me at my chambers, which I have once had reason to suspect," I said to Wemmick when he came back, "is inseparable from the person to whom you have adverted, is it?" Wemmick looked very serious.
"I couldn't undertake to say that of my own knowledge. I mean, I couldn't undertake to say it was, at first. But it either is, or it will be, or it's in great danger of being."
As I saw that he was restrained by fealty to Little Britain from saying as much as he could, and as I knew with thankfulness to him how far out of his way he went to say what he did, I could not press him. But I told him, after a little meditation over the fire, that I would like to ask him a question, subject to his answering or not answering, as he deemed right, and sure that his course would be right. He paused in his breakfast, and crossing his arms and pinching his shirt sleeves,
His notion of indoor comfort was to sit without any coat. He nodded to me once to put my question. "You have heard of a man of bad character whose true name is Compeyson." He answered with one other nod.